This is an interview with Marcella Sorg. Today is February 5th, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. Okay, so just to get us started off, I'd like to ask you how you got interested in forensic anthropology.
Well, forensic anthropology is not my primary discipline. I'm a physical anthropologist, and so the forensic is an application of physical anthropology to forensic problems. And I've been doing that for a while, but I didn't start out that way. Mm-hmm. And I got involved in forensics because the chief medical examiner of the state of Maine asked me mm-hmm. to start doing cases
I see.
For the state of Maine. And that was in 77.
Oh,
all right. So I've been doing them ever since.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I currently do the forensic work, the anthropology for four states.
Hmm.
Maine, New Hampshire, Delaware, and Rhode Island.
Can you tell me about some of the tasks that involves?
That involves doing recovering and examining decomposed and skeletal remains, basically.
To solve various crimes?
It involves criminal cases as well as suicides and missing people and frequently, it's a combination
uh-huh.
of those two things. Occasionally it's a historic set of remains, an unmarked grave that turns up on the landscape.
Can you tell me a story about that?
Well, I think that what we should do is talk about the center. I could go on and on about that, and I, mm-hmm. but I don't typically talk about my cases.
Sure.
And that's not part of my research.
Mm-hmm.
My research has to do with postmortem processes.
Mm-hmm.
So we could talk about that, but I would rather not talk about my cases.
That's understandable.
Yeah.
And let's talk about your research.
So my research is in the field of taphonomy,
mm-hmm.
and that concerns the fate of remains from the moment of death till they are discovered. For paleontology, it would be, a long period of time from the moment of death till they are fossilized and discovered and mm-hmm. studied at that point. But in forensics, it's a shorter postmortem interval, so we'd be talking about decomposition in the early stages of preservation or lack of preservation until the point of time that mm-hmm. a body is discovered.
Mm-hmm. And what methods do you employ to do that kind of work?
The recovery of remains is, we use standard archaeological techniques as well as a set of techniques when we're doing searches for scattered remains. We employ cadaver dogs and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Look at environmental contexts, including things like temperature and vegetation and mm-hmm. climate. Burial makes a difference,
mm-hmm.
Body covering and that sort of thing.
Sure.
But in terms of the taphonomy is actually something that I've been doing since I got started in the Institute, which was in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Institute received a grant, specifically one member of the Institute, Rob Bonickson, received a grant to set up a center for the study of the earliest peopling of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I got involved and became the associate director of that center. And we did some things in having to do with taphonomy and having to do with climate change that have endured, even though the center is not still here. In terms of the history, I think this is where we should go in our discussion, because
sure.
that's the part that is not generally, it's not as so easy to find.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd love to hear about
okay.
it. So, Rob Onnickson asked you to direct the center.
No, he was the director. I was an associate director.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And we did several things as part of that center. We were focused on issues around whether or not and the timing for the peopling of North and South America.
Mm-hmm.
Controversial topic. A lot of argument amongst scientists about when that happened and how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
The center's actions were really directed at illuminating the research that was going on globally on that topic. And so we did several things. We started a publication series. We published quite a few books.
Mm-hmm.
We started some outreach work to other disciplines and to the public. We started a newspaper that came out periodically called The Mammoth Trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
And both the newspaper and the publication series is now at Texas A&M.
Mm.
The whole center moved when Rob Onnickson left the university.
He went to Texas A&M, I take it.
He went first to Oregon and then the center went to Texas A&M, and I'm not clear on that part of the history and the timing of everything. It
mm-hmm.
happened after I left the center, which was in 87.
Mm-hmm.
But while we were there, while I was there with him for about 4 years, we did quite a bit that I think increased the visibility of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have one fairly large international conference in 1984. You can see the bone modification conference, because we were looking at, you know, a lot of times archaeologists are focused on stone tools as an indicator of human presence. And Rob was particularly interested in the use of bone tools
mm-hmm.
and modification of bone.
Mm-hmm.
And connected with that is taphonomy and what happens to remains after they die and how do you interpret marks on bones and, you know, breaks and fractures and their condition.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a conference that was focused on that, and in that conference we included quite a bit on climate. It was held in Carson City, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one a book that came out of that conference here. Which is still used today. It's an edited volume on bone modification, but it includes not only, it's a very strong taphonomy kind of set of research, and it includes
mm-hmm.
issues concerning the forcing function that climate can play in human evolution. And this is one of the first places where some of that work is discussed.
Fascinating.
And it's still, you know, a very important part of what the Institute is about.
Mm-hmm. So you said that at a certain point you left the center.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
I was, for family reasons, and I was doing more consulting in those days, and
mm-hmm.
so for about 10 years I maintained my affiliation with the university, but I didn't work for the center.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Bonnickson was not an easy person to work with, and he didn't last here for a number of those reasons, which I won't get into, but the center then moved to Corvallis, believe, and then to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It moved after I left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can walk me through how 10 years later you re-immersed yourself into the Institute.
I was all that time doing my forensic work, and in fact, during that time, did two books on taxonomy, and was basically doing forensic research, and I was also doing, epidemiology and public health related things that are not connected to the Institute
mm-hmm.
for Climate Change. But I work with substance abuse quite a bit, and was working with the Margaret Chase Smith Policy Center, and there were a couple of grants that came during that time, the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
that kind of brought me back to the university. And then in the 2000s, I got a big grant from Department of Justice, and at that time I reconnected with climate change
mm-hmm.
and have been with them since 2010. Formally.
Mm-hmm. So what sorts of things have you been doing in the last 10 years or so?
I work in two areas. I work in public policy and public health with the Margaret Chase Smith Center. I do drug-related epidemiology, and I work a lot with the medical examiner's office to do that because we're looking at mortality patterns and
mm-hmm.
particularly drug-related deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have also been doing forensic taphonomy all that time.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2008, I got a major grant from Department of Justice to study regional taphonomy, in other words, what are the factors that are associated with a particular region that might bear on decomposition patterns and that sort of thing. And we did a case review, and we did a study of 9 pigs in various locations out of doors, and watch over them and documented scavenging activities and insect activity and plant activity, and that went on for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point I'm working on a book that is going to come out for related to that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been mostly, the research has been in those two areas.
Sure. How do you see that connecting to climate science?
The climate is a critical set of variables that bear on how organic remains are, for lack of a better word, processed after death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big recycling process, you know, when animals and plants die.
Mm-hmm.
And that recycling process is mitigated by and affected by climate, obviously. You know, how much moisture there is, how much heat. Those are the two biggies. What kinds of scavengers have access, the plant population. And so regional climate makes a big difference in how we interpret forensic remains.
Have you had much opportunity to do research with other members of the Institute?
When I did my grant with the Department of Justice, I involved a number of other people in the research, including Hal Borns and Ann Diefenbacher, Kroll, and some minor involvement by Ivan Fernandez. And there were a few others that got peripherally involved because, you know, I had questions or... But those were the main ones.
Primarily Hal and Ann.
Yeah. Got you.
I wonder if you can maybe walk me through your collaboration with Hal and Ann. What parts of the project did they take on?
Well, they were helped advise us, Hal, in the geological interpretation of sites. So, you know, how you characterize a location in terms of its... And by the way, and Alice Kelly wound up doing some of that. Hal was unavailable for a while, and so Alice Kelly was involved as well. And, for example, the issues that affect taphonomy have to do with the slope, with the porosity of the substrate, and how much drainage there is. Does moisture accumulate in the site? Does it flow away due to the slope? That sort of thing. And so they helped us think about our sites in that way. Ann was helping us interpret the plant life associated with a dead pig, essentially. But it could, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a dead deer, a dead pig, or a human death, you know. They're similar things, and one of the issues we were interested in was something called the decomposition island and how it develops, and it actually kills the plants at that location, and later, after the body is gone, a new set of plants show up, and the plants look different. They have a high amount of fertilization, and so we can use the appearance of this decomposition island as a way of searching for the location of a body in forensics.
What do you think has been the Climate Change Institute's most important contributions to climate science?
I'm probably not in a good position to answer that question, but I, in a specific way, but I'll talk about it generally. And I think that the advantage and contribution here have to do with the interdisciplinary collaboration primarily. And it's very difficult on a university campus to make that happen. And Hal made that happen for the Institute for Quaternary Studies, and then it was the name changed later to Climate Change Institute. But he was able to create a structure that guaranteed that people would actually talk to each other and deal with each other, and the university was behind it. And it's very tough to do that. You can say that you're going to have a, you know, collaboration, But if you're in separate departments and you don't have shared funding, it's almost impossible. And so the idea that this would have a university supported infrastructure, a place, funding, and of course we've been very successful getting external funding, all of us, and it makes a huge difference. And so that is rare. It is rare in academia. Most departments are siloed, and they're siloed in terms of their funding, and they're siloed in terms of the interaction that they have. And so the Climate Change Institute involves anthropology to a great degree, history to a great degree. It's not just the earth sciences that are, although traditionally it's the earth sciences that have made climate change research, have done most of the climate change research. Here it's different. And we've really been able to do things, especially with the archaeology and the long time frame that other places just don't do.
So you are a little bit of a walking distance from, say, Sawyer and Bryant, where probably the majority of the members are housed there.
I have an office in York as well. And so I spend a fair amount of time over there.
Okay. All right. So that that helps.
Well, and all of the anthropologists are here, but we meet over there, and we're, you know, we're back and forth.
Right. And I suppose also the annual gatherings perhaps help as well.
But we have research that brings us into contact as well. The funding, as I said, funding streams make a difference there. And, you know, we have staff meetings and that sort of thing.
How often do you have staff meetings?
It's about once a month or so.
And that includes all members of the Institute? Where do you meet?
At Bryant, third floor.
Yeah, and is there sufficient room, do you find?
It's crowded, but yeah.
Yeah. How do you think the Institute has evolved since you first became involved in the 80s?
The structure has endured. And I think there are a lot of things that were in place then that are still in place. I think we had in those days pretty good visibility statewide in terms of policymakers. I think that it is still true today. It's bigger now, obviously. There have been a lot of changes in the leadership, but the mission has stayed pretty much the same.
What did you think about the name change? Did that seem to maybe undercut the role of, say, archaeologists and anthropologists in the Institute?
No, I don't think so. I certainly it's a little more focused, but I think that's necessary. Academia is increasingly required to make itself, to explain itself to the public. And so I think the name change is an indication of that attempt. I mean, the previous name was just a more general focus on a time frame. But certainly the biggest important feature across that time frame has been climate. And it is climate that is clearly interdisciplinary. So I don't have a problem with the time with the name change.
Sure. Speaking of popular culture, it seems to be the case that within the scientific community, there is no debate about the human role in climate change, but outside the realm of science, it's still very much debated, particularly in American popular culture or political culture.
Yeah, I think that's changing, but that's certainly true.
Yeah, I wonder if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
I think people are just, uninformed.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's as simple as that. And you know, when you're uninformed, then your political agendas and other agendas are more important.
So if certain oil, those involved in the oil industry, for example, if only they knew better or knew the science behind climate change.
But they're not scientists. And so, you know, this kind of push-pull, I think, is a normal thing. This happens all the time, and as we try, public policy is done by non-scientists. And the problem of technology transfer into the public sector and into the brains of people who make policy is a continuing problem. How can we expect the people who are policymakers who have these little committee meetings? I'm not minimizing it at all, but you know they have public committee meetings with hearings, and somehow we have to inform them. We have to get enough into their brains so that they can make good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not going to school. Although it's a very educational process for them to have these hearings.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is tough. I mean, they have to run the government, and they don't have knowledge in the specific areas where they are making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very tough and understandable that we have a problem here.
Should the Climate Change Institute play a role in educating the public and influencing public opinion about climate change?
I don't think its goal should be influencing public opinion, but its goal should be public education, and it is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I participated, for example, in a book recently that we did for Maine's Climate Future that you've probably seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an example of an effort to educate the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's our job.
Maine's Climate Future, how was that distributed to the public? I mean, was that something?
Thousands of copies were made.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I wasn't part of the distribution process, so I can't answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
But it was made available mostly to policymakers and community representatives, and you know, it's been distributed very widely.
Mm-hmm.
And on the website, I mean, that's the other place that it's available.
Mm-hmm. What else has the Institute done in terms of public outreach?
I can't comment too much on that. I haven't been directly involved with those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that various people have testified in hearings and that sort of thing. We've certainly made ourselves available to communities that have needed, you know, advice about things. Where a lot of us are involved in a lot of climate projects that have community outreach here at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm not currently doing that, so I can't, I'm not a good person to answer that question.
How do you see the Institute evolving into the future?
I think that climate is one of the biggest issues that we're facing as a species. And so I think that they will end up growing in their role as the go-to place for scientific information.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something I didn't think to ask you about.
No, excuse me. It's okay. No, I think we've covered the waterfront as best as I can.
Sure.
Can do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you once again for participating in this interview.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.